What law allows our government to make war against its own citizens? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy, and along with me is Chuck Michaelis, our Vice Chairman. Hi, Chuck.
I'm always glad to be here with you.
Okay. If you've been following us this week, we've been looking at the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, and I know I'm butchering that last name, but that's okay. You know who it is. You've heard it enough over the last couple of weeks on the news. An American citizen who joined with al-Qaeda, went to Yemen, and became their regional operations director, where he was working to launch attacks against the United States from his base in the mountains of Yemen. On September the 30th of this year, well, actually, we'll go back on April the 10th, I believe it was, of 2010, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, gave the Justice Department, and we're finding out now that maybe it wasn't just the Justice Department and the CIA, the green light to go after Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, that sentence was carried out on September the 30th of this year when an unmanned drone plane flew in and released missiles which killed Anwar al-Awlaki, another American expatriate to al-Qaeda, and about five other foreign nationals. So what we have here is a situation where we have to unpack this constitutionally based on our rule of law to find out if, number one, what we did, could we do what we did? And number two, did we do it correctly? Now, we've talked about the role of our Congress in declaring war and issuing what we call letters of mark and reprisal. We've talked about the provisions of declaring someone to be treasonous is vested in the courts, especially the Supreme Court of the United States, in Article 3, Section 3, and that no bill of attainder can be issued by our Congress to basically declare someone treasonous by legislative fiat. It must go through our courts. With our rule of law as we have. But now we get down to the point that this order was issued through the executive office of the president, who is commander-in-chief of our armed forces, yes, but was carried out by our military, in some respects, because now we have the Justice Department, the CIA, and I believe the National Security Agency, all somewhat coming to the surface as being part of the chain of decision-making in relation to this particular elimination, I should say. I was going to say extraction. Elimination of Anwar al-Awlaki.
Well, without putting too fine a point on it, the fact that the military is working in conjunction with the Justice Department is exactly what the founders were trying to avoid by setting up the rules the way they're set up. And in fact, it's why there's a law in this country called the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, the Posse Comitatus Act mostly applies to things within the borders of the United States, by my understanding of it. But the fact is that the military is not supposed to act as the police, and the police aren't supposed to use the military for law enforcement. So is this really a Justice Department issue?
Well, that's a good question, because according to media press reports, and really, ladies and gentlemen, that's the only thing any of us have to go by right now, because it'll probably be years before all of the secret and classified documentation that led up to the events of September the 30th of 2011 will be actually unveiled or released or declassified for us to piece together what actually really happened. But supposedly, the drone strike, which ended in the death of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen born in the United States, two parents of Yemeni extraction, so his parents were not American citizens, but he was born on U.S. soil, making him a natural-born United States citizen. That drone strike, which killed him, was led by the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Not our military, but the CIA, who, along with the Justice Department, gave the Justice Department supposedly gave approval to the CIA to go after this man, and the CIA goes over there and flying unmanned drones kills Anwar al-Awlaki. Now, what we're also finding out from reports is that the actual list of people that the CIA, the Justice Department, handed to the CIA was not developed by Congress. It was not developed from a list that the courts had ruled, had had in open court either a confession or the eyewitness of two witnesses, as we talked about, that's in our Constitution that must be before you can declare somebody in treason to the United States, even though Anwar al-Awlaki had given, as we said, in Article 3, as part of how you could be found to be treasonous, that you are adhering to your enemies and giving them aid and to the enemies of the United States and giving them aid and comfort. Obviously, al-Awlaki was doing this, but he was, as far as I can tell from everything that I've been reading, there was never a time when any court of competent jurisdiction in the United States, whether it be a federal district court, the circuit courts of appeals, or the United States Supreme Court, ever issued a judgment of treason against Anwar al-Awlaki, specifically. But what we have here is a special grouping who have no oversight, supposedly, who don't answer to Congress, who don't answer to the people because they're not elected, but a special group inside the National Security Council, I believe, and I'm going to double check to make sure that that's what that is. It could be the National Security Council, it could be Homeland Security, but I think it's the NSC, that they are the ones who generate the list of targets that American, we give the green light to go and eliminate as part of the war on terror. Now, Charles, can you enlighten us a little bit about, because Congress declares war. Did Congress declare that war?
Congress issued a joint resolution basically authorizing military action, which gets us into a real conundrum because it isn't officially a declaration of war. It's essentially telling the president, go get them, which is exactly what the framers were trying to avoid. They did not want the president to be given a free hand. There's another consideration in that. What they've essentially done is that they've said, you have all the power to do this, 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 and this, and this, and this. And they've handed him unrestricted authority to go in and use the military as a police force. Well, that's not the point of military action. And in fact, when we read Vattel's whole idea behind the issuance of a letter of mark and reprisal was to basically exact retribution and recover damages short of war. So this isn't, again, we're not in letter of mark and reprisal territory. We're in war declaration territory, but we don't have a declaration of war.
Okay, and that's a dangerous place to put us in. Now, I went back and did a little review while we were sitting here discussing this, and yes, it was. It's a small panel that's based in the United States National Security Council, who actually have it's a list that they mark whether the person should be killed or captured. And yes, there have been American citizens, Anwar al-Awlaki being one of them, placed on that list. Now, as far as I understand, Chuck, and maybe you can help me with this, this panel of the National Security Council, which are senior government officials, which answer to the President of the United States, because that would be under the executive branch of the government. Am I correct?
That's
under
correct.
Our Constitution?
Yep.
So they answer to the President. Most of them are probably senior, since they're senior officials, they're appointed by the President.
Right.
They are creating a list of people to capture or kill based upon their interpretation of whether or not America is at war and how those particular nuances of the Constitution of the United States operate. Now, they hand that list off, supposedly. Now, and this is where it gets really fuzzy, because right now we have a difference of viewpoint as to whether or not this panel gets the approval of their boss, the President of the United States, or whether or not he's even really checked off on this list or has actually directly seen this list before the Justice Department, which is another agency under the executive office of the president, which means that they answer to the big guy as the boss. Not only is he commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but he's also the head of the Justice Department and the head of the National Security Council and chief muckety-muck over all of the senior governmental officials who are on this secretive panel. But there's a question and a confusion as to whether or not the big boss, the chief, the guy who's supposedly making the decisions as commander-in-chief, has actually seen the names on this list. Now, supposedly, we've got back in April of last year that he did see this list and he did check off on it. And knowing that these people, you would assume that their intelligence is strong enough that they would realize that this guy was born in New Mexico, so it makes him an American citizen, that he's an American who's turned enemy. Now, I almost said traitor, but they can't make that determination, and neither can the Congress. Only the court can make that determination, according to the Constitution.
And there's what unfuzzifies the picture right there. The fact is that the National Security Agency, on its own, and whether the president looks at it or not, because the president has no right to issue an attainder, and certainly no agency on the basis of intelligence, whether it's good intelligence or bad intelligence, they do not have the power to issue an attainder. Now, remember, it's not a bill of attainder because there's no legislature involved.
Correct.
This is simply a finding of guilt by I'll be quite honest, in my opinion, again, this is my opinion, is a rogue and rather Orwellian agency in the National Security Agency, simply telling people, issuing orders to the military who needs to be caught and captured. Well, capturing would be under the purview of the Justice Department. Say, you're okay with capturing this person because we want them brought back for trial on treason.
Well, certainly, considering the fact that they're an American citizen, whether they've left the country or not, I mean, many Americans travel abroad. And if they get into trouble in a foreign country, what's the first thing they do? They look for the American attaché or the American embassy to declare their rights as American citizens to be protected under the laws of the United States. The Amanda Knox case being a situation, although that was British, it's still the same idea. But the point is that was the process that possibly should have been followed, is capture to bring back to the United States to stand trial in a court of competent jurisdiction for treasonous acts against the United States. And once found guilty, and as we talked earlier, probably by his own admission and videotapes, he's declared he's an enemy of the United States and he's given aid and comfort to the enemies, which meets the standard under Article 3, Section 3, who then could be executed for treason. But right now what we have is the National Security Council investigating and using lawyers and review, look at the situation, input from the military, and they make sure they follow international law. What about our own United States Constitution? That didn't seem to take... There doesn't seem to be as much concern about following the U.S. Constitution and how we've done the process from the beginning as there is about following international law just to make sure we don't create a firestorm on the back end by going with the president having a letter of mark and reprisal, which is what this sounds like it really is.
Yeah. Well, there's another consideration, and you brought it up, and that is that what seems to be happening, and we're running really short on time, so we'll probably have to continue this, but basically what's happening is that the National Security Agency has decided, probably with the prompting of the president, that international law, the new form of international law, supersedes constitutional law, and they may be calling into various treaties and agreements and that kind of thing. And the fact is that Article 6 is very clear that all treaties must be made in pursuance to the Constitution. You cannot arbitrarily say that this treaty supersedes the Constitution. Treaties cannot supersede the Constitution.
Okay, and so tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to finish up this discussion. We're going to talk about the Article 6 issue regarding treaties, and we're going to come back to making a constitutional determination of where we stand now and what precipice we may be looking over. So stay with us, because we'll be back tomorrow with more of this on Principles and Policies.
Join us tomorrow at 5:30 for the show. We're hoping to see you.